Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you once again without co-host Andy Bailey. He continues to just mess up his priorities, something about he needs to study for law school midterms, blah, blah, blah. He needs to get his life straightened out. But as we keep our season preview train rolling, since we are so damn close to the start of the NBA season, I am very excited to be joined by Jeff Siegel, a writer for The Step Back and Peachtree Hoops. And as you might have guessed from that Peachtree Hoops affiliation, he is here to talk about the 2017-2018 Atlanta Hawks. How are you doing tonight, Jeff?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing spectacular. I'm ready to talk about some Hawks. And I told this to you before we jumped on. I'm irrationally excited to watch what should be a fairly bad team.
Oh, yeah. This team is not going to be good, and the point of it is not to be good, but it's going to be interesting to watch. They've got a lot of young guys who are they're not really relying on to be superstars in the future, but if they could, you know, push it forward a little bit and, you know, show some things this year, that would go a long way toward, you know, the next great Hawks team.
We're allowed to call this a rebuild, right? Like, I know GM Travis Schlenk, and I'm probably butchering his name beyond belief because I suck at pronunciations, but he doesn't want to use the word rebuild. He talked about they're investing in their future, this nice hedge against, oh, we're not trying to compete now, but we want guys who will be competitive, but we're also not tanking. But we can call this what it is. Like, this is a thorough, like, let's basically start from scratch and let's rebuild.
Yes, this is a rebuild. This is not a... They're not trying to really be competitive. That's sort of a smokescreen that both the owner, Tony Ressler, and Schrank, and I think Budenholzer as well, has used just sort of in interviews and stuff like, oh, yeah, we're going to be really competitive. We're going to try to, you know, we're going to try to win. It's like, of course, you know, the players are going to try to win because everybody's trying to play for their next contract. You know, there's a whole bunch of guys who are either on one-year deals or two-year deals with an option, and a bunch of guys who, you know, are looking to get paid in the next couple of years. So they're not, none of the players are going to tank. Like, you never see that, but really, like, this is not going to be a competitive team. This team is going to put up like 92 to 95 points a game. I mean, it's going to be really bad, and it's just, but that's the whole point of the team, that's what they're trying to do. You know, their best asset on the entire team is their own draft pick that's coming at the end of this year. And that is, that's the goal of this year, is to get that draft pick as high as possible.
I mean, they might wind up, and you mentioned this before we went on, you might wind up, you probably should wind up with, you know, the Houston pick, and then you're going to get the, hopefully again, the Minnesota pick that's lottery protected. So if you go in there with three first round picks this year, and I think the GM even pointed to it, they have five first round picks in the next two drafts, which is just, you know, that's good. That's great. Those are good building blocks, starting points.
Yeah, that's exactly what you got to look for when you're trying to rebuild. Having your own first round picks like almost isn't even enough these days. You have to have multiple first round picks from other teams, from whatever kind of trades you can make. And in those, that Minnesota pick is lottery protected the next 3 years. It came from the Adrian Payne trade, who's now a two way player in Orlando. So that was a great trade for Atlanta. And then
let's just clarify, two way contract and not this two way superstar. I know a lot
right.
of the listeners
will
get confused.
Yeah, not a two-way superstar like Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah, he's
he's a two-way player, literally, like, part, you know, very little NBA experience and a lot of G League experience this year for Adrian Payne. So that worked out famously for Atlanta. And then they've got that the Houston pick that's top three protected this year from when they picked up Jamal Crawford from the Clippers earlier in the summer, and they just cut him because they don't even need they don't need what he brings to the table, so they bought him out, and they'll just take that cap hit most of it this year and a little bit next year.
I'm notoriously mad for anyone who listens or follows me, which is not many people, but notoriously angry that they lose Al Horford for nothing, and then I thought the same thing was going to happen to Paul Millsap. They did well to just get a first round pick out of that, because those were two players, and it's not, again, it's not on the current regime necessarily, because that sort of switched over this summer, but to lose let's call them two top 25, top 30 players for nothing, like, it's just kind of disastrous when you know they're free, and especially because they were involved in trade rumors. That was something I just couldn't get over, and I was very silent about it over the offseason, because it's like, oh, you know, they got a first-round pick out of Paul Millsap's departure.
Well, yeah, they got a first-round pick out of Paul Millsap's departure, but it wasn't because of the way the contracts and everything were structured. He literally, that first-round pick didn't literally come in for Paul Millsap. Like,
right.
He wasn't actually part of that three-team trade. It's a little weird, but essentially the cap space that he vacated by leaving allowed them to take on Crawford's contract and get that first round pick. So I guess you could sort of say that he was part of that. You know, he did get net a first round pick, sort of, but that was a little bit weird. But it's a strange sort of. They were in a strange place with Horford coming in the last summer, Bazemore also, and they decided to retain Bazemore, and then they decided to get rid of Horford and bring in Dwight Howard, which obviously worked out incredibly poorly. And Bazemore, I'm on the record saying they shouldn't have done the Bazemore thing, not just because last year went poorly, but like immediately as soon as they signed him in 2016, I was like, that's not a good thing to do. You know, they have. You know, we know about Hawks University. We know about how they can develop wings, you know, very, very well, take bottom of the scrap pile wings and turn them into, you know, $15, $20 million a year players. Why pay one of those guys that you developed when you know you can develop guys like that?
On the bright side, they did not match Tim Hardaway Jr.'s four-year $71 million deal from the Knicks.
Well, that was never going to happen unless, somebody had an aneurysm in their front office or something. Like, that was never... I don't think they ever considered that for 5 seconds. I think they took the full 2 days because they could to say, oh, we're not going to do this. But I think within 5 minutes they were like, no, we're done.
I would give them 5 seconds. I think the Zach Lowe of ESPN.com had a report that they were thinking like 4 years, $48 million. And the Knicks came over the top by $23 million, which is dumb. And anyone who uses the restricted free agent defense, it's just wrong. The Knicks gave out a 2016 contract in 2017 while the market was just shrinking before their eyes. So that was one of the more bizarre moves. But you're right that they do a good job of developing wings, and you're probably one of the few who disliked, I would think, the Kent Bazemore deal. But there was a lot of everyone, I won't say everyone, but at least I know I was confused and a bunch of other people ended up being confused. But like, the market was just misread completely leading in from last summer to this summer. And I think the Bazemore deal was kind of safeguarded under that 2016 umbrella for the longest time until he slumped off last year, which didn't help on the offensive end, especially. And so his contract didn't look great, but it really wasn't until the 2017 free agent market unfolded that it looked truly horrid.
Yeah, I think a lot of 2016 contracts look like that. Like, I think when Allen Crabbe got paid, it was like, yeah, that's probably too much for Allen Crabbe. And then you saw this summer, it's like, oh man, Allen Crabbe is one of the worst contracts in the league, even though like, just because of the way market sort of fell off from 2016 to 2017, you know, guys like Evan Turner, we knew were going to be bad contracts immediately, but like the way the 2017 market has come out and the way the 2018-19 markets look, you know, those contracts are just absolutely killer for the teams that they're on.
Yeah, I shouldn't admit this, but I was for the Allen Crabbe deal in 2016. You probably just described my Twitter timeline by the progression of how I viewed it. And I was one of the few who thought that Evan Turner might actually work in Portland. So people are probably wondering why they're listening to this podcast at all right now with those admissions. But this is not a 2016 free agency podcast, but tangents are fun. Dennis Schroeder is now, like, he's the – I mean, Atlanta kind of finds himself in a weird spot just because most teams, I would think, don't start a rebuild and have all this money committed to – two guys who Kent Bazemore's not a cornerstone player. Like, he's not even really in their timeline anymore at his age. And then Dennis Schroeder, like, it's still kind of a wait and see situation. Yes, he's only 24, but you already have him on his four-year extension, which, you know, his isn't a bad deal. What is it, 4 years and 62, I think he's on?
He's 4 years, 62, but he's got some incentives that if he hits this year, pushes that cap hit up by about $2 million. So like, he could be on like more of a, you know, 4 for 70, which would, you know, maybe look a little bit worse.
Right. I mean, 4 for 70 for a starting point guard is probably whatever. But it's a weird spot because I don't think you can say, oh, he can be like the face of this team, or he can be the, let's even say the 1B or like the second guy on the team that we're striving to become. And I'm wondering what you kind of think is going to happen now that, like, they've slowly but surely they've just ripped the safety nets out from under him. Like, Al Horford was gone before last year. They trade Korver midseason, then Millsap leaves and they begin this rebuild. And, you know, the offense was okay when he played without Millsap last year. I think I was looking it up beforehand, NBA Wowie, they pumped in like 105 points per 100 possessions. Not great, not awful. Probably, I think it's relative to what the Hawks were doing overall last season, like, you would have taken 105 points per 100 possessions from them because that's more than they average for the year. But I'm just curious to see, do you think he can kind of be this guy who's going to be from the ground up the leader of this offense, like just the man.
I mean, he's going to have to be because they don't have anybody else who can do what he's doing. So he's going to be the guy, but it's going to be the guy on a 30-win team. So is that, does that count as really being the guy, or is he, you know, I don't think he can be the 1B or the, you know, the second best player on a solid team, on even a playoff team. But, you know, he can certainly lead this team to a 25-30 win season. Maybe he can get a little bit better from where he is now. I mean, he's got all the tools. He's incredibly fast. He might be one of the 5 or 6 fastest players in the league. You know, he almost led the league in drives per game last year. Other than Isaiah Thomas, I think he was second in the whole league in drives per game. But then he gets into the paint and he can't finish, and he can't shoot when guys go under screens, and he's not a very good passer, and he's sort of an inattentive defender, even though he's got these long arms and he's incredibly quick, like he is on the offensive end. That still translates. He's still incredibly fast on the defensive end, but it doesn't really translate into positive, you know, defensive contribution. So he's just, he's got all the tools, and he has to take a step forward in so many different ways that he could take a step forward in just one of those. He would be, you know, a top 20 point guard, which would be fine. That's better than where he is now, which he's probably like, you know, maybe 28th to 25th in the league. And, you know, in terms of starting point guards, he's got so much to move forward that he can pick any one of those. And if one of them can go forward, that would be great. And if he can move all of them forward, now we're talking about something real.
The drives are interesting, and it seems in the preseason that the Hawks are just running a bunch of these like 5-out lineups, these offensive schemes, and that's going to help him because he shot okay on drives, but you're right, he's not a spectacular finisher around the rim. He shot under 56% inside 3 feet last year, which is not very good. He doesn't draw a ton of fouls on those drives. His assist percentage on those drives was not that great either, but if you're going to have 4 guys around him on the perimeter, 3 of them, you know, if you're gonna have Dewayne Dedmon just drag himself out of the paint, like he shot some jumpers over the course of his career, some of which went in, but he's not going to be that 3-point guy. But if you're just going to clear the paint for him, it'll make it a lot easier. And I don't know that he'll ever be, you know, his speed is the weapon in itself, so if you get by someone, his man, and then there's not really help behind him, that's going to be a big deal and would help him a lot, just because he's not the guy that you're going to rely on to finish in traffic, to finish over these guys with that vast array of floaters. And, you know, again, he's only 24. He's entering his 5th season in the league, and it's only his 2nd as the everyday starter. So maybe he develops these things, but I have to think that this model, and I'm not necessarily saying the Hawks offense will be good, because as you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it most likely will not be, but being around within those types of lineups where there's just so much space being created, which it seemed like that was a little something the Hawks struggled with last year, that could be an individual boon for him throughout this entire season.
Yeah, I think you'll see him put up numbers. I don't know how much you can really put behind the numbers that he will, you know, put up, but he'll, you know, the offense will be a little more spaced out this year. That's probably the only way in which it is going to be better, is that the shooting will be a little bit better. They're going to play guys like Ersan Ilyasova, Luke Babbitt, who can all, you know, if they can't do anything else, they can shoot. And so that'll help Dennis in terms of getting into the lane and fit. And hopefully, you know, he'll you know, have a tick up in his finishing this year. But, you know, it's whether that can translate when you don't have shooters at every position.
Right.
Yeah, I have to see it before I believed it.
It would be nice if Kent Bazemore kind of regained his 3-point stroke, would help a lot. And he's another one. Actually, I would like to see a lot. Again, he's 28 years old, and there are guys who should get minutes before him. But Luke Babbitt, I would just love to put him at the power forward, and let's see him do what the Miami Heat did last year. Like, his average shot distance, I think, was closer to 22 feet last year. Like, just give him the green light from 26 feet and in, or even 28 feet, and just let it fly. Maybe that helps you as well. That's just me. I don't think that doesn't advance their development, but I'm just all for, if you're going to run these 5-out lineups, or where you're going to have try and have four shooters on the floor at all time, maybe try and play really fast and just do those driving kicks like that. But Kent Bazemore was my main point. He's weird for this team too. He has 3 years and $50+ million left on his deal. Do you think this is a situation where he's not going to be meandering in and out of the trade rumor mill because the Hawks aren't really in a position, nor should they be, to sweeten that contract? Or do you think if maybe he gets off to a nice start and he's putting up some numbers on a team that is gonna, I can assume, and you can definitely point me out if I'm wrong. They're going to rely on him to be that kind of secondary playmaker even more than they tried to last year, that perhaps they're hoping that becomes a movable deal, because this is this 28-year-old. He has 3 years left on his deal. I know a lot of people aren't big on timelines, but by the time his contract's up or by the time the Hawks are ready to going to be good again, he'll be on the wrong side of 30 anyway.
Yeah, I mean, if he can regain some of that secondary playmaking ability, that would go a long way toward making his deal a little more movable. I mean, this is somebody's going to need to step into that role in some way, because you look literally across the roster, there's no above average passers on the entire roster. Maybe you could argue like Mike Muscala is above average for his position, mm-hmm. but you're not running an offense through him. You know, Dennis is not a great passer either. You know, none of the point guards are passers. Delaney's not a passer either. You know, Bembry might be a passer depending on, where you see him. But like, you know, he was in and out of the G League last year, and I don't know exactly what they envision for him this year. I hope we see a lot of that. But, you know, Bazemore, if he can regain some of that playmaking ability and doesn't, turn the ball over, most of the time when he drives, which is, a problem. And if he can regain even just a few percentage points on that jump shot, then yeah, you're looking at something that, you're looking at maybe a $12, $13 million a year player. And so you have to attach a smaller asset to get rid of his bigger contract, but at least it's not, it's not unmovable.
Yeah, I think when you look at the bad deals throughout the NBA now, as a result of that 2016 bonanza, his probably doesn't rank too highly on the immovable scale. It looks better than Evan Turner's, that's for sure. It's not a Timofey Mozgov or Jan Mahimi situation. So if you're right, if he's going to regain, if he can, maybe he can score some points for them or create out of the pick and roll, maybe a spot up shooting improves. I would say he was okay defensively last year. If that kind of holds, maybe there's a contender that can talk themselves into a 3-and-D. And I don't necessarily know what the team would be, but if they have some expirings or short terms that they can just send back to the Hawks, that would be interesting to explore. So I guess that would make the question, my initial question, what it was trying to get to, is do you think that this is a team that's going to want to move him like this season? Do you think that's going to be an active goal that they view him as? I don't want to say he's clogging in the pipeline, but they would rather give his minutes to a Bembry or just have more flexibility to play Taurean Prince additional time.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody will comes to them with a decent offer, I think they'll really think about it, and they will, probably end up moving him. But I don't know what team is out there that would want that contract for 3 years at a a bloated number compared to the value that he brings onto the floor. But if somebody shows up and wants him and is willing to even just take him for without attaching maybe that Minnesota pick or something like that, then I think the Hawks really do have to think about that.
And as I mentioned before, well, Bembry and Prince, I guess, are two players to talk about kind of together. Everyone liked a lot what they saw from Prince last year. I'm more curious about Bembry because he seems like he could be very fun on defense. It seems like he might even have an extra layer of playmaking that we haven't seen or that has been untapped. And again, you've watched him way more than I have, so I could just be totally off base here. Are the Hawks, even like when he's on the floor, are they even going to encourage him or let him shoot threes? Or is this just going to be, a situation where they avoid it at all costs for him shooting from the perimeter?
I think everybody is going to shoot on this team. If you're open, shoot. Like, that's the whole point of the offense at this point. I mean, even if Dwayne Dedman is spacing out to the corner and shooting threes, why can't Bembry shoot threes? Like, let's just have everybody out there shooting. I think that's pretty much what they're going to do. They're going to put the ball in his hands a lot in that secondary, in that bench unit. I think, I mean, I was watching the Grizzlies game last night, and he's got the ball in his hands, and he's making passes, and he's one of the better passers on the team, and he can operate out of the pick and roll and at a higher level than I think a lot of people might think, given that he didn't play that much last year. The shot is not good. I mean, he just airballed a corner three last night. Like, it wasn't, it wasn't even particularly close. He'll have to work on that, and hopefully he can get that going. But like, if he can't shoot, but the rest of the team around him can, like, I think you could put the ball in his hands and sort of mitigate that a little bit. So we'll see exactly how they use him. But I do think that he's a solid passer, a solid pick and roll, sort of secondary pick and roll guy, but could be a primary for a bench for a bench unit if necessary. And he, you know, he's a good decision maker. He rotates really well on defense. That's something that really pops out on the tape. Like he anticipates really well. You know, you can see his college experience when he plays, you know, and the way he rotates defensively, the way he can sort of sniff out pick and pops, and he'll rotate over from the weak side corner and take that pass away. You know, stuff like that. I think he's a smart guy. I think Budenholzer really likes him. And I think, you know, I think he will see a lot of time this year because, you know, again, this is a terrible team, so you might as well see what you got in pretty much everybody.
I was completely just caught off guard with what they've done with him in the preseason. Like, I just, when I saw him having the ball a lot in his hands, like, that's not something I even, like, realized or thought was an option leading in from the offseason. I clearly didn't watch him in college, and as you said, he barely played last year, but then you look and he's averaging 7.4 assists per 36 minutes in the preseason. Again, such a small sample size, but you even said it, he has the ball in his hands a lot more, and that's, I know the Hawks are kind of thin in the secondary playmaking department, but I never would have seen this coming. Like, you asked me a week ago. I don't even think I would have named him as, like, the top four or five guys that they would turn to kind of generate in the half court or run pick and roll, or just have the ball in their hands at all.
Yeah, I mean, he's surprised me even this preseason with the way he can pass and the way he's finding the guys in the weak side corners off pick and rolls. And, like, he's just – I think he's a high-level passer, and he can, you know, hopefully he can continue to build the rest of his game around that so that – they can really use him as a secondary playmaker.
Taurean Prince, a lot of people consider the more promising prospect. Are you right there with him? It seems like these two guys can do a lot of the same things defensively, and there's going to be a greater hope, obviously, for Taurean Prince's outside shot. It was 32.4% last year as a rookie, but he was taking them. And he showed, I think, later on in the year, it looked like he could knock down some of those shots, and I don't even know what the word would be, but he was kind of a grinder on the defensive end, and that's kind of, you know, these 3-and-D things, like, that's the buzzword, that's the highly coveted commodities, is even if they're not there yet, but you can kind of see the silhouette of one, everyone wants the guy who's going to be able to switch a little bit on defense or just handle defending those bigger wings and then maybe stretch the floor a little bit on offense. And I don't think that he'll ever be this high-end guy in maybe in any one category. Like, he's not – I don't know if he's someone that you consider as this Hawks guy, looking at them and saying, oh, he's a legitimate primal building block, but he seems like maybe he could be on the closer to a Jay Crowder trajectory, where he's like this great universally complementary role player, and he's going to knock down some threes, but he's going to basically play his ass off on defense as well.
Yeah, I think that's – you've pretty much nailed it with that. I think – Prince and Bembry have a lot of similarities. Prince is bigger, which is great for the Hawks because they've never had a big enough wing to contend with, like, LeBron and Durant and Kawhi Leonard and guys like that. You know, those are the hardest wings to find, is guys who can play defense at that size. But I think Prince could eventually get there. He's one of those guys who has a bunch of relatively average to slightly below average skills. And if he could just take a leap in one or two areas, that would really help him. But even if he doesn't, he's already like a relatively solid role player. You know, if the shot can move up a little bit, if he can, you know, get a little bit bigger, a little bit better defensively. You know, coming out of Baylor, he was playing a zone mostly because of the way that Baylor plays. And so he's still getting used to playing NBA man-to-man defense. But when he gets stuck in just like a straight isolation against some of these guys, you know, he can hold his own. He's a big dude. He's relatively quick. He's, you know, so it's just he can do it. He's got the physical skills, and he's got the big profile that Bembry just doesn't quite have. Bembry's more of a, you know, get through screens, guard guys like Klay Thompson, stuff like that. Whereas Prince, I think, would get stuck a little bit guarding guys like Klay. But, you know, Bembry's way too small to guard the bigger wings. So I think that's a really nice pairing defensively in terms of what they can do, you know, on various matchups. But and then Prince has a little bit of that secondary playmaking. You know, it's one of his sort of average to below average skills for his age and his experience level, but it's not, you know, nothing pops with him other than just, you know, how big he is and how, you know, just his physical profile yet. But other than that, like, I think he doesn't really pop in any area, but he has a lot of solid skills that he can advance over these next 3 years of his rookie deal.
Do you think he can kind of be, and maybe Jay Crowder really hasn't had a shot to do this, and, well, he absolutely hasn't had a chance, but do you think he can be a little bit more self-sufficient than Crowder on the offensive end. Like, we've seen Crowder develop his handle nicely, where if he can pump on drives or if he can just attack off the dribble, like, you can trust him to make shots. But you're talking about how you have he has a little bit of the playmaker in him. He did shoot 35.5% from three over his last 22 games last year, so that's something defenses will respect, and that opens up the opportunity to, again, pump and drive or just attack right off the catch. But does he maybe have the capacity, and how likely would he be able to explore that with the Hawks, of running some pick and roll? And, you know, you're not going to – I'm not saying bring the ball up the court, but if you're going to reference that, this search for a secondary playmaker, do you think he can actually turn into something more than a Jay Crowder in that department?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to see that this year, because they've got so many – they've got 82 games worth of experimentation to work with. So let's just see what we can get out of Prince, out of whoever. You know, I think Prince will – I think he will bring the ball up at times, whether Dennis is in the game or not. I think they'll give him free rein to take pull-up jumpers in transition. We saw a couple of those last night, I think. Like, it was just – they'll give him the leash, and if he's good, then they'll continue to let him go on that leash. And if he's not, then they'll rein him in. But I think this is the year of just mass experimentation, because, you know, what else are you going to do? And so this is, you know, I think we will see Prince run, you know, a few hundred pick and rolls over the course of the year, and see how that works and how it goes, and, you know, what can he do with the ball in his hands, and can he pull up for, you know, one of those mid-range, can he pull up off the pick and roll for a mid-range jumper? Can he pull up for three off of the dribble? Like, that would be a nice skill to have, but we don't, you know, this is the year to experiment and see if he can do those kinds of things, or even see if it's something that they would want from him down the line, because he's one of the guys, I think, probably along with Schroeder, just because of his contract, Prince and Bembry, and of course John Collins, and then whoever they draft at the end of this year, those five guys are sort of the building blocks at this point for the, you know, 2020-2021 Hawks that might actually be, you know, somewhat competitive. Like, so let's see what all these guys can do. You know, put the ball in John Collins' hands and see if he can run a pick and roll just for fun. Like, why not?
Oh,
like, let's just
love that.
Yeah, let's run some 4 or 5 pick and roll with him and Deadman, or him and Muscala with a pick and pop. Like, let's just, like, this is the year to just do all the things that you would never do if you were trying to win games, you know? And so, like, I know, like, Budenholzer is going to want to, you know, really, you know, he's going to want to win because he's a coach, and that's what, you know, that's what coaches always want. The players are going to want to win. The players are going to want to be successful. But if Schlenk can convince the players and Bud to really – to do this, like, let's get nuts. Like, this is the point. Like, let's do this. Let's just, you know, go nuts and see how it goes.
And it's funny, I say, before you start talking, those fantastic points you made, I'm saying, well, not necessarily bring up the floor, but if you, I look at the Hawks depth chart, it's like, well, if they're going to experiment, they should absolutely let him bring himself off the floor, because there's just nobody after Schroeder. I mean, like, they have Malcolm Delaney technically, but, like, he's not that guy. So, of course, Bazemore and Prince, and as you said, even Bembry, and then you're throwing out Collins. So I think I underestimate, like, how experimental this team needs to be. Do you think it's, and this is probably a two-part issue, do you think that they should almost be remade in the image of the Nets from last year? Not in the way that they're bottoming out because they don't have picks, but it was a free-for-all. Like, you saw Trevor Booker bring the ball up the floor a lot last year, and maybe you do just give John Collins the green light to do that. And then the next part of that would be, you know, Budenholzer, not only is he not Schlenk's guy, like, he had to relinquish some control when they brought him in. Do you think that this organization is on the same page to that extent?
I think so. First question is about the Nets. I think it'll look a little bit different, but it might be similar in terms of overall sort of idea and the overall philosophy behind it. I think, well, Kenny Atkinson came from Atlanta, and so
right,
and he's the head coach in Brooklyn, and so he comes out of that same mold from Budenholzer and from you know in the Popovich coaching tree. And so I think, you know, if Atkinson can go to Brooklyn and really experiment with a bad team, then maybe we will see that out of Budenholzer. That's a good point that I hadn't really considered. But I think the Nets were really three happy, and they just launched their threes. I don't think the Hawks are going to be quite that way, mostly because Dennis Schroeder isn't that guy. And when he has the ball, he wants to get to the rim, and he's not a great passer. He's not a particularly willing passer. When he gets into the paint, he really looks for his own shot. So I'm not sure that the shooting profiles will look the same, but I think in terms of experimentation, it's going to be fairly wild. And if it's not, then they're sort of wasting wasting the time, the precious time that they have where there's no pressure to win, and you can lean into some of these experiments and just see how they go. In terms of whether Budenholzer has sort of the backing of management and ownership, I mean, without really being in those meetings and knowing anything, because the Hawks are notoriously incredibly tight-lipped about anything, I think Budenholzer has the backing of ownership, has the backing of management at this point. Whether that changes, whether Budenholzer even, you know, gets antsy and wants to leave because things aren't going well and he doesn't want to be around a losing team, you know, that's possible too. He's been, you know, he came from San Antonio, walked into a team the second year, they won 60 games. Like, he's a winner and he wants to win. And so it's going to be, you know, there might be a little bit of a struggle internally for Budenholzer to say, like, I don't really, you know, I could get another job in a place where maybe, you never know, maybe the New Orleans job opens up at some point and he wants to go coach Anthony Davis and maybe, you know, bring back Boogie Cousins, stuff like that. You know, there might be a place for him where he voluntarily decides to step back from the Hawks, you know, but I don't think at this point that anybody internally in the Hawks are thinking about removing Budenholzer from his post at this point.
Well, I guess it would be, one, actually, to the previous question about the Nets, I hope they're at least, do you think the Hawks, they were 10th in pace last year, or are we going to see them build upon that ranking this year?
Yeah, I think we will. I think we will, only literally because Dwight Howard's not on the team anymore.
That's a fantastic point.
Let's just, you know, you might as well run. You've got athletes. You've got Bazemore, who likes to run. You've got John Collins, who will dunk on anybody. And, you know, you've got Prince and Bembry, who both sort of like to run a little bit. And then Schroeder, of course, is like the third or fourth fastest person, with a basketball probably on the planet. And so, you know, you might as well get out and run. And so I think they will, because Dwight's not holding everybody up while you're playing 4-on-5 for the first 5-6 seconds of the shot clock every possession.
Right, and Dwayne Dedman can run too, but for him, to imagine going from what San Antonio does on offense to then all of a sudden you're on a Hawks team that's probably angling, I would think, and that I was just trying to get confirmation on that, but they should probably rank in the top 5 or 7 of possessions used per 48 minutes. Like, just imagine the shell shock from that. He's long and lean and likes to run too, but I just find that, like, that's just such a 180 stylistically.
Yeah, so I wonder, so the style might be a little bit more similar than you might expect, because, well, not just because Budenholzer came out of the Popovich right. coaching tree, but because the Hawks did like to play fast, and they like to play fast to get the ball up the court as quickly as possible. But then when they get into their offense, the offense takes a little more time to run. I actually wrote about this at Peachtree Hoops, like, what does playing fast mean? Budenholzer has talked about, like, oh, we want to play fast, we want to play with purpose. What does that actually mean? And I'm not sure that means, like, let's get out and transition and try to find transition threes and layups. I think that means get into the offense within 4 or 5 seconds of the shot clock, but then run the offense down to the last, you know, 5 to 8 seconds. So I'm not sure that the increased pace will show up in the pace statistic, but I think, like, if we could track, like, how long does it take for the ball to get above, you know, past half court, I think they would rank pretty highly in that statistic, which we don't even have. But if we did, like, I think that's what they mean by playing fast, not necessarily get out and transition all the time.
Well, I'm going to let you know, I'm going to be really upset if that's what it means. That'll be very that was one of the intrigues I had for this team, was watching them fly up and down the floor just because Schroeder is so fast. And you talk about him being one of the 3 or 4 fastest guys in the game. As you said that, I was like trying to think in my head, John Wall might be ahead of him. I don't know. Like, do you put Russell Westbrook, who just seems like more? Is he faster than Schroeder? Is he just more of a bulldozer than Schroeder?
I would probably say, I think Westbrook is functionally faster because he's just such a freight train with the ball. But you might as like you could like I'm not sure if you lined him up side by side and did a 40-yard dash, Schroeder might win. But like once you have the ball and you have to contend with, if you step in front of this guy, you are going to go through the basket stanchion. I think that's where Russell sort of surpasses Schroeder in terms of functional speed.
And then I'm trying to think, I mean, who else would be on that list? Like, Isaiah Thomas is really fast, but I don't think it's him.
Isaiah Thomas he might fit in that mold, in that same Schroeder mold, where he's just got a really solid first step and he can really get to the rim. I mean, he was first in drives per game last year, but then, you know, they were running some really more handoffs and pick and roll for him, whereas Schroeder, you know, a lot of his drives literally just came off of like a spot up catch and just running right by his guy. You know, but you know, outside of Wall and Westbrook, I'm not sure that anybody's really out there that's faster than Schroeder with the ball.
Yeah, I mean, he's fast. And since I diverted from the Coach Bud topic, maybe it'll be, and that's more so what I was wondering, maybe it'll be a situation where we'll know if he is on the same page or on board with what the Hawks are doing when we look at his rotations. Because if you're going to see Kent Bazemore play 35 minutes a game, you're going to see Deadman get a lot of minutes over Zach Collins, or and even throw Mike Muscala into that. Then it's kind of, and you know, if you're going to play Ersan Ilyasova a bunch instead of giving Torian Prince some time to dabble at the four, as I think he should, maybe that would be kind of a sign of, because you have to imagine, especially with Schlenk saying they're investing in the future, that the mandate has been, even though they're saying we want to be competitive, like you have to like prioritize the kiddies.
Yeah, and they will. I think they will. I think you can look at the preseason rotations and sort of see, you know, obviously in preseason he's playing a longer rotation and more guys are getting time so that they know, you know, who's good and who's not going into the year. But I think we're going to see a lot of Bembry, a lot of Prince, a lot of John Collins, you know, and they're not going to get stuck in the back end of the rotation like that. I mean, Torian Prince is going to start. I'm pretty sure he's going to be the starting three. He's the only three on the roster other than Nico Prissino. And Prissino, you know, may not make the team. I think he will, but he, you know, there's a possibility that he's not even on the team. So Prince will definitely get his minutes because he's going to start. He started down the stretch last year, started the playoff series against Washington. So he's definitely going to get his minutes and get his starts. And, you know, I think Bembry will step up behind Bazemore, and Bazemore won't play more than, you know, maybe 28-30 minutes a game, just because, you know, he wants to play because of his contract and just because he wants to prove people wrong. And of course, playing him might make him more tradable, which would be, you know, good for the Hawks as well. So I don't think we'll see anybody play much more than maybe 30-33 minutes a game. Maybe Schroeder will be the only one, but even then, like, they kind of want to see what they have with Malcolm Delaney because he's going to be a free agent after the year. They've got Quinn Cook, who I think is pretty interesting, just to see what they have there. You know, you might as well. This is the year of might as well. Like, let's just try things. You know, let's try it. Let's play three point guards just to see if it works. Like, you never know. What if you trip over something? I mean, I wouldn't expect them to do that, and I don't expect that works. You know, talk to Phoenix about how that works. But, you know, I don't think they're going to do that. But, like, those kind of ideas, those kind of off-the-wall ideas that you would never run in real life, this is not real life because this is an experiment of a terrible team that you can just kind of do whatever you want with. So I do think we're going to see a lot of the kids, and obviously I hope we see a ton of them.
Well, that would be another like corollary to the Brooklyn rebuild, is just, you talk about guys who didn't, Brooklyn didn't have anyone who averaged over 30 minutes a game, and Atkinson went like 10, 12 guys deep every night. And I guess that's the setup Atlanta will kind of mirror. And it's a little bit out of necessity because it's like you said, they want to get looks at some of these other guys. And you have those veteran glue guys who are there. My favorite of whom is Dewayne Dedmon. We have to talk about him because I was such a fan of him in San Antonio. He's serviceable. And if he's going to shoot from the perimeter on Atlanta, like, I'm here for it. Like, he's not shooting well from three in the preseason, but we're talking about Dewayne Dedmon. Like, he shot threes in the preseason. Like, that's actually happened. I'm just here for it. I love more of what he does defensively, because when we talk about the bigs who don't shoot threes or these non-unicorns, like, you have to still on defense be able to defend almost like a wing, and he just has this switchability to him. He's long and he kind of has a little bit of the Nerlens Noel in him, where it looks like he teleports sometimes on defense because he's in these spots so quick. And it's not just he needs to be this stationary rim protector. You need to keep him within 10, 12 feet of the basket to make sure that he's going to make his rotations. Like, this is a dude that will close out. Like, this isn't Nikola Jokic syndrome, where part of what hampered him on defense last year is that he needed to close out for the Nuggets because they were in such disarray. I just love Dewayne Dedmon, and I was so happy he went to the Hawks because they kind of have to play him. I know there's Muscala and you want to get Collins some time, but this is a guy, he wasn't in and out of the rotation necessarily in San Antonio, but it's just playing time wasn't guaranteed. Like, it hinged on Pau Gasol being injured or whether they were going to bring Gasol off the bench and things, the variables like that. We're going to get a chance, it looks like, to really see him play some serious minutes here, and I'm very excited to see what he could be defensively. And the Hawks, to that point, could be, if they're going to surprise people in the East in any way, you have to imagine it's going to be on the defensive end, in part because of they have some nice front court pieces there who should be able to get them some stops, no matter, you know, you have a rim protector in Deadman, maybe John Collins becomes that nice shot swatter. He's even a guy who hustles his ass off defensively too. So that might be where they're going to surprise you most. And I think if it happens, Dewayne Dedmon's just going to be a huge part of that.
Yeah, for sure. I think he's been the biggest surprise for me from preseason so far. Just, you know, obviously just the fact that he's even willing to space out to the corner and shoot those threes, even if they don't go in, that's just amazing to see, you know, especially after living through a year of Dwight Howard last year. But, you know, I think you get the feeling from his last year in San Antonio that he got on Pop's bad side because he would have games that were decent and then he would just find himself totally out of the rotation at certain points. And you were just like, when the Hawks signed him, you know, you don't know what's happening behind the scenes in San Antonio. And obviously something must have happened where Pop called Bud or Bud called Pop and was like, hey, we're thinking about Dedmon. What do you think? And obviously Pop gave him the go ahead to do it. I would imagine that conversation happened. So I would think that Pop liked him, but for some reason he wasn't really getting the consistent playing time, but he's going to get a ton of playing time this year. He's going to be the starting center. He's going to play a majority of minutes, you know, at that spot because, you know, again, Muscala will play his standard backup center minutes. He's like a perfect backup center. He's not good enough to push the starter, but he's not so bad that you're like hemorrhaging points or not able to score when he's on the floor. He's just good enough to be a backup. And I don't think they're going to see a lot of John Collins at the five this year. You know, we'll see.
No.
You know, again, it's.
Well, how'd you break my heart like that?
It's an experimental year, but I think with Dedmon and Muscala, I think there's not going to be a ton of time for Collins at the five. They're going to try it because they might as well again. But I think it's going to be a lot of Dedmon. It's going to be a lot of Muscala. And I think Dedmon will, you know, he'll have the chance, and this is it for him. If he can, really do well, then he can opt out next year and make a lot of money somewhere, whether it's with Atlanta or not.
Here's what probably shouldn't be a question, and I'm hoping it's a tough one, but if it's too easy, then whatever. Who makes more threes next season, Dewayne Dedmon or DeAndre Bembry?
Oh, that's just kind of mean to Bembry, isn't it? That's really mean. I think Bembry will, just because, I mean, he won't have the playing time, but like he's got to be, he'll be out there more. He'll be out on the perimeter more during, you know, when he's out there. And that's a little mean to Bembry. I think he's at least, you know, somewhat, he's probably a better shooter and he'll be out on the perimeter more than Dedmon will be. So I think Bembry is the answer there. But, you know, if it's not, then that means something went really wrong for DeAndre, I think.
Do you think it could be close? Is it that unruly of that mean spirited of a question that it won't even be?
No, it's not mean spirited. It's just, you know, when you think about a shooting guard versus a center who's been in the league for a while and has never shot threes, you know, you think that the shooting guard would at least be able to knock down more threes than the center, but you know it's a weird world, and so you never know what if Dedmon can find. Dedmon will be open if he goes to the corner, and if he can knock those down, you know he'll have the playing time to pass Bembry in threes overall at least.
Something that did catch me off guard about like Dedmon is, no, he's never shot threes, but he's had like these random small bursts of success on long twos. Like 8% of his shots in 2015-2016 came between 16 feet and the three-point line, and he shot 35.7% on them. And then last year in San Antonio, a smaller share came from that distance. He was at, I think it was like 4% and change, and he shot 45%+ on them. Again, really small samples, and I only actually know this because I wrote an in-depth piece for him for NBA Math like in the middle of the year because he was so shocking. So maybe it's not, I'm not even relating it to the question, but maybe it's not like perhaps he turns into something where these guys aren't going to leave him alone and you can't cheat off the corners on him because he's all of a sudden shooting. You know, if he gets 28-30% of his threes, like that's a problem for defenses.
Yeah, I mean, if and that'll open up the floor for everybody else. I mean, when you think about what this team was last year with Howard and Millsap, even like Millsap can shoot threes, but it wasn't his preferred thing to do. So both of those guys were closer to the rim. And if Dedmon can shoot, and Ilyasova, we know will shoot, and John Collins, you know, we'll see what he can do from outside. And we know Mike Muscala can shoot. That's your four bigs right there, who all will space the floor and at least be out there. And you have to sort of contend with them, and that's going to open up a lot of lanes for Bembry, for Prince, for Tyler Dorsey if he gets some minutes, for obviously for Dennis Schroeder.
And we haven't really talked much about Mike Muscala, but his free agency deal was good. That, like, he's just this, he can space the floor at the five, and he can be okay as a stationary rim protector. If you're going to get that for 2 years and $10 million, like, why not? And I think, I think I'm actually stepping on toes with what you said, but he's probably an above average passer for a guy who's going to spend most of his time at center. And that's another really interesting piece to look at. I'm interested to see how he fares in this offense that seems like it's going to emphasize more space and maybe just a little bit more freedom for everyone that's involved. You know, Schroeder is going to get into the lane and he's going to look to score, but you don't have to worry about placating a Dwight Howard with post touches. You're not trying to get feed Paul Millsap every possession down. It's going to have this equal opportunity feel to it, and I'm very interested to see how he might perform in it.
Yeah, I think with Scala, I think if you were really in depth watching this team last year, and I don't know why you would be unless you write about them, but if you were, you would see that when Muscala came off the bench for Dwight, the offense just flowed way better. Maybe the numbers, I don't think, even really bore that out, but it just looked better. It looked like people were cutting and moving, and you could run a few little things through Muscala as a handoff guy, as a passer. He is probably a better passer than most centers in the league right now. And he's, you know, I know he really likes it in Atlanta, and I think he's, you know, that may be why he took, you know, relatively a smaller deal than maybe he could have gotten elsewhere. But, you know, he'll have a chance to opt out after this year and get paid again if he's able to really either push Dedmon for minutes maybe, or just, you know, show what he can do a little bit more now that Dwight's out of town. But I think he's, you know, he's sort of that perfect guy on both ends. He's just good enough to where he's really serviceable, but not, you know, he's not tricking anybody into believing he's a starting center at any level of the NBA.
And I guess he's going to get a ton of minutes too, because I come into this thinking there was going to be ample time for John Collins at the five. But if you think that they're going to give him some real spin at the four, and that's where he's going to spend a majority of his time after the preseason, that there's a ton of minutes there for Mike Muscala, because you don't need to play Miles Plumlee at this point. Like, you know he's dead weight. You're not trying to make him a part of your future. And if someone gets injured, if you just want someone else that you're hoping can be a nice rim runner out of the pick and roll, you throw him in there. But if John Collins is going to be a four this year, or a lion's share of his minutes are going to come at the four, there's going to be a lot of time available for Muscala.
Yeah, I think so. And I think Collins will probably play the four this year. He'll just be more comfortable there. They'll be more comfortable putting him there until he can sort of, if they decide to make him into a five someday, then they'll have to sort of beef him up physically and to get him there. But I think he'll, this year in particular, he'll play the majority of his minutes at the four. And Miles Plumlee, like, if he never sees the floor the whole year and all they do is just ride his contract out over the next few years, like, that wouldn't be the end of the world. But then there's like this small opportunity where they may throw him out there and try to improve his tradability a little bit. I mean, we keep saying he's one of the more untradeable contracts, but he's been traded twice on this contract. So it's like, it can't be impossible to get rid of this guy. So, you know, I hope they don't, because they want to play the young guys and they want to play Muscala and they just want to play guys who are better. But if they want to try to rebuild Plumlee's value, I wouldn't be totally opposed to giving him a little bit of run at backup center. And even, you know, Muscala can, because he can shoot a little bit, because he can pass a little bit, because he can handle the ball a little bit, he can actually play the four. He would play with Dwight every once in a while. He would play with Al Horford back when Horford was in Atlanta. You know, he can sort of makeshift some minutes at the four, especially because they have Ilyasova, they have Collins, and the next four on the roster is like Torian Prince or something. So it's not, you know, maybe they do a little bit of that so that they get Muscala and Plumlee a little bit of a few minutes together, just to see if Plumlee can rehab a little bit of his value. But I would expect that Plumlee won't play almost at all this year, really.
Now, John Collins, are you as high on him as NBA Matt's founder and editor in chief, Adam Frommel, who we recorded a Nuggets podcast roughly a little bit more than 20, like 2 days, let's say, before you and I are discussing right now, and he took a Nuggets podcast and made it into a John Collins tangent for a good 5 minutes?
Probably not, if he's that high on John Collins that he's taking Nuggets podcasts. I mean, there's so much interesting stuff to talk about with the Nuggets that if you're taking that and navigating toward John Collins, then, you know, maybe you're really high on John Collins, or you're related to John Collins in some way. But, like, I think Collins is going to be worth two or three highlights a game. He's going to get lost on defense, because that's what rookies do. And, you know, he's going to be fine. He's going to be really exciting. He's going, if any time that somebody watches a Hawks highlight, he's going to be involved, or it's going to be Schroeder just like running, you know, full speed down the court and missing a layup, which, you know, is going to happen a lot. But, you know, Collins, he's super exciting and he plays with so much energy and he seems like just like one, you know, a really good guy, good teammate, is willing to do a lot of the dirty work. He'll pick and roll, and then if it doesn't work, he'll sprint out into that second pick and roll, something that obviously we didn't see a ton of with Dwight last year. Like, he's, you know, he's just boundless energy, and he can leap, and he can do a lot of things. But in terms of how, you know, good he is or will be, you know, I'm not entirely sold that he's going to be – that he's going to even be, like, the best player or the second best player on a good team, you know, when the Hawks are ready to be a good team.
Now, some people are going to take this as an insult who haven't watched him, and that's fine. Could you maybe see him being a taller, longer version of Trevor Booker? And if you want to say a better version, fine. But, like, he looks like he just – like, the motor on him is just off the charts, and maybe he's the guy who's going to shoot. I mean, if he's going to play the four, and you said it – I don't know how many times I forced you to re-say it in this podcast, but everyone on the Hawks is basically going to shoot threes. So he's going to get to experiment with that, and he just – he seems like that workaholic, and like you said, with his commitment to out of the pick and roll, he's going to hustle on the glass too. And that was when I did draft prep and was making comparisons. Like, I just saw there was no similarities in the body type, so I can't stress that enough. I'm not even trying to insult him. If you want to say it's like a super rich man's billionaire's Trevor Booker, like, if that's what people like, that's fine. I see stylistically in terms of how much they hustle and how much it seems like both of their effectiveness is founded upon that hustle, I kept coming back to him, and that's ultimately what I rolled with because I couldn't find a good comparison for John Collins.
I think he's got a little more offensive play than Booker does. I think he's somebody who you could at some point throw the ball into and let him operate out of the post a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't put a lot of that in this year, but I think he's somebody who could be somebody like that in addition to all the hustle plays and, you know, perhaps shooting a few threes. But I think he's, you know, I think a comparison like that isn't totally incorrect. I think he'll be a better version of what Booker gives to his teams. But, you know, I think he's got a little more to bring to the table in terms of just a dump him the ball and let him go to work than Booker has.
Not totally incorrect is one of the best compliments that I have ever received, so thank you. And, you know, the Nets did, they dumped it a lot down to Booker in the post last year, and he wasn't very good. He shot 50% in it, but 111 possessions in the post, so I just want to make the point for the people there who obviously haven't watched as much basketball as you that was not an insult to John Collins, who, according to Mr. Frommel, is the best player to come out of Wake Forest. And has he made the point, Tim Duncan doesn't even score anymore, so...
Yeah, the Tim Duncan isn't even on a basketball team anymore, so maybe he is the best Wake Forest player to ever come out.
Right, and
which is
like Chris Paul hasn't even
sure.
made a conference finals, so like how is he even going to be included
right.
on the
Neither
list?
Is John Collins, but sure, like let's just start throwing stuff out there.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Collins is interesting. Like, you know, we'll see what he can do. You know, he's a rookie, so I'm not going to be high on him pretty much no matter what, but I'm like notoriously super low on all rookies. Just like until you can prove it to me on an NBA level, I'm going to just assume you're a rookie. And if he drops, you know, he dropped a 19 in the draft, which, you know, he's come out and said like, oh yeah, no, I should have gone top 10. I should have gone wherever. Like, you like to see that kind of confidence from a guy, but I don't think that I don't expect him to be a, you know, a massive, he'll play a lot, but I don't think he'll be a real positive contributor on this team in terms of bringing value, you know, bringing positive value to the table this year.
It runs into two problems. Is one, so I'm working on an NBA top 100 project for Bleacher Report that'll go live eventually. And it's, you don't include a bunch of rookies because aside from the number one picks and maybe the number two picks, like they're like barely ever are these guys outside of their more than, or they're not even replacement-level players. And yet, when you know what we know about number one picks, where, let's say, Karl-Anthony Towns, like, he was the number one pick, and you could say when he was a rookie that he was probably better than a top 100 player, he was better than a top 50 player, and yet it's still so hard for me to place, like, a guy like Ben Simmons who has the same transcendence attached to him. And that's what's so weird with rookies. And then when you move into the guys who are deeper in the draft, like John Collins, I just don't – it's always so hard for me to get expectations for these guys, even when you're talking about how many minutes they're going to get, even when you think about how well, you know, if John Collins is going to just run the floor and cut toward the basket, and then he's going to try and make some hustle plays on D, just block shots and maybe switch a little bit, like, okay, that's fine. But I think it's just so complicated with rookies. And I've always found that fascinating because I grapple with, it's not just, I can't even assume like the top rookies are going to be good, even though when you look at number one picks, like, yes, there are busts, but a lot of the times, like the real good number one picks, like, for instance, like the Karl Anthony Towns, or they're supposed to be like better than average immediately. So the rookies are always so tough for me to talk about and understand and even envision how they might do.
Yeah, I think Collins in particular, you know, he's not, I don't think he should even sniff your top 100 list. The only player on this whole team who might sniff it is Dennis Schroeder, depending on how high you are on him. But there's nobody else on this roster that's even close to being in consideration for that top 100 list. And Collins certainly isn't in that list, I don't think. But, you know, and he's, you know, for all of his hustle and for all of his, you know, perhaps a little bit of switchability onto smaller guys, you're not going to put him up against bigger guys for sure. Like, so if he plays center offensively, he's probably not going to be able to play center defensively, at least not very well. Mm-hmm. And if Bud is, you know, really, you know, Bud is more of a defensive coach than an offensive coach. And if he can sort of get, if he, I think he'll see, he'll try Collins at the five and he'll see him just get overpowered and overrun and just get out of position on pick and roll and all sorts of stuff. I mean, Collins is still a rookie and he wasn't particularly great defensively in college. So he's not, I don't particularly expect him to be, you know, a high level defender or even a below average defender. He's probably going to be pretty terrible. And so putting him at the four can, you know, can mitigate that a little bit. He can switch down, but switching up is not going to be something that he's going to be able to do at this point.
If you are interested, Dennis Schroeder did make the top 100. And if you're also interested, it killed me to not include Dwayne Dedman, who there's like the, like these, he was one of the guys that I just believed that could end up on that list, even though no one would pick him. And I ultimately just had to cut him because I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I think he could be somebody who might make a top 100 list next year based on his performance this year with consistent minutes and a consistent role. You know, maybe he shoots a few more threes like we've been talking about. You know, there's it wouldn't be unfathomable that he would make that list. It's not unfathomable that Taurean Prince could jump up that list if he can sort of take a few of his average skills and push them to above average. You know, now you are looking at a top 100 guy. But Schroeder makes, you know, I think Schroeder does make sense as sort of somewhere in that sort of 85 to 95 range. I'm not sure where you put him, but I think that's where I might have him.
Do you want to know where he is?
Sure, yeah.
He was right at the end of your range. He is 96.
Okay, that makes sense. Like, I wouldn't think that's wrong in any way. I think if you have him much higher than that, then you really believe in his ability to get that shot or get that passing skill down or just be a more attentive, better defender. But for what he is right now, yeah, somewhere in that bottom 15 makes a ton of sense.
So with all of this said, the Hawks, what do you see their floor is? And it's so, I don't like doing floor and ceilings necessarily with teams that are really rebuilding, because if they get a ton of wins, like, that's not necessarily like a good floor, like best case or worst case scenario. Like, it just becomes blurred when you're trying to figure out the motives of every team. I do think the Hawks are a little bit different because I don't think they would I don't think they're one of those teams where if we're going to see Phoenix just rest a bunch of guys and shut them down the stretch, I don't think that Atlanta would be the type of team to do that if they are hotter than we expect. So I think this question is a little pertinent. What do you think the ceiling is on this team? But, you know, best case scenario, we're not assuming, you know, that they trade for like this huge impact player. Like, just looking at this roster, where it lies, what could you see them doing if things break right for them, especially in the wide open East? We didn't really talk about that, but the East is a shit show.
Yeah, the East is terrible, and it's going to be terrible, and it's, you know, it's going to be a situation where I think the biggest thing, instead of pulling a Phoenix and resting some of their guys down the stretch, if they get to January and they're sort of in the playoff hunt, I expect Schlenk to just pull the trigger on some trades, get Ilyasova out of there, get Dedman out of there, just try to do some things that would push them down the standings a little bit. Okay. You asked me to do a floor and ceiling before we jumped on, and I actually reversed it. I think the ceiling, the best case scenario would be the ceiling, and that's like 24 wins and the second best lottery odds. And the floor is like 32 wins and, you know, pushing, you know, maybe 10th in the East, and all of a sudden you're looking at this like they've got a mid-tier lottery pick and where, you know, but they're nowhere near really being a contender. So I would say, I mean, I personally really believe like this needs to be a rebuilding year. This needs to be a year where they don't win more than 26 to 28 games and really try to get a real impact player. Because this coming draft, from what I understand, and I'm not a huge college basketball or draft guy, but from what I understand, like the top four or five guys are all real impact guys. And so it's really important this year, on top of the fact that the lottery odds get a lot worse in 2019 and going forward, this is the year to be really bad. And if they're anywhere near being sort of good, then Schlenk's going to start pulling triggers on some guys in trades.
It's an interesting dilemma when you're doing a floor and ceiling for this team, right? As I was like, just the, do you reverse it? Do you not reverse it? That's a very, like, an interesting sort of just sub issue to those types of questions.
Yeah. I mean, like, cause you never know, like, you never know what the motives are really. Like if what they're saying publicly isn't really a smokescreen and they want to be as competitive as possible, I mean, yeah, they could win 30, 32 games and take themselves out of the top five draft picks. I hope they don't, for their sake and for my sake, in terms of just watching a team that eventually might be good again. You know, it would be nice to go through that rebuild. We've seen what it can do for a team like Philly, who took a bunch of stabs at a bunch of bites out of that top five apple, and now they've got a really up and coming great team. You know, hopefully someday. You know, that they'll, I don't think that they're the Philly, you know, sort of as a tangent, that Philly's going to be very good this year. I put a lot of money on them to miss the playoffs and to go under their 41 wins, but that's a whole nother thing. I think that's sort of team building with the incentives that are currently in place. That's, you know, that should be the way that they do things. And so hopefully Schlenk is on board with that, and hopefully the ownership is on board with that. I could see Ressler, with things, if things get, you know, things are going kind of well, maybe they're just below 500, you know, 40 games into the season, and Schlenk's like, hey, we, you know, remember we kind of wanted to be bad this year so we can get a good draft pick? And Ressler's like, oh no, like this team's really good. What if we win the first round of the playoffs? It's like, I worry strongly about that, but, you know, we'll see.
Now, so I'll put you on the spot here a little bit, because I don't normally ask for the super specific scenarios, but because it's the situation, what do you ultimately see happening with this team win-wise, place in the Eastern Conference? And if there's, you know, if it's a, you know, if you're going to say they win, let's say you're going to say they win 26 games because they're a little bit better than teams expect, and then Schlenk just finds a way to trade Kent Bazemore because he's one of the reasons why they're pretty good. So what is your gut? And it's all gut feelings here, but what are you kind of seeing as the middle ground and what's actually going to happen for this team?
I think Bud will buy them more wins than people expect. Like he's a good coach. They're going to play hard. He's going to come up with some crazy sideline out of bounds stuff that'll net them a win or two here and there. So I'm looking at like 28 wins and maybe like 12th or 13th in the East, which probably will put them, you know, right about fifth in terms of lottery odds. And, you know, if something happens, they can jump into that top three, but mm-hmm. We'll see. But I think I'm going to go with 28 wins.
Do you think, is Kent Bazemore on this team by the end of the trade deadline?
Yes, because nobody else will trade for him.
Fair enough. The real last question would be which teams are actually worse than them? Like that we know are going to be worse than them in the East. I know people are like on the Nets train. I still think the Nets could be worse than the, I go back and forth with them. They're going to be super fun to watch, but I think you could probably come up with between two and four teams that you know are going to be worse than the Hawks. Like, I'm not sure if it's basically the Knicks, the Nets, and the Magic at this point. Like, those are maybe the only three contenders. And I'm with you. I don't think Philadelphia is going to hit their 41 wins either, by the way. So they could...
Yeah, but I don't think Philly's going to be so bad that they're going to be in this conversation.
I think
Chicago, Orlando. Brooklyn, you know, maybe are below the Hawks in terms of talent and coaching and sort of what that can do for a winning team. But, you know, some of those teams are looking to try to win. Orlando has a little bit of a core that they'd like to move forward with. Brooklyn, of course, would, you know, like to turn around their franchise at some point in the future. And, you know, between Chicago and Atlanta, I think those are the tanktastic teams that would start trading guys off, would start sitting guys to try to improve their draft position, I hope.
Well, there you have it. This was great. I appreciate you giving us so much of your time, because we went over what is the normal podcast here. But the Hawks, again, are a fascinating team to me. So we want to thank Jeff for being just so generous, giving us more than an hour to rap about what's going to happen in Atlanta this season. If you want to follow him on Twitter, and you should, especially because he's deeply into the salary cap, which is going to help you when we start talking about off-season scenarios, and most certainly in the off-season when you're trying to figure out if your favorite team has the space or the resources to sign a big-name player. So he's great there, too. Follow him at JG Siegel. That's JGSIEGEL. He is a writer, again, at The Step Back and for Peachtree Hoops. Definitely check out his stuff. His insight on the Hawks is top-notch. If you want to get at me on Twitter, I'm at Dan Favale. That's F-A-V-A-L-E. You can follow Andy Bailey, even though he abandoned you tonight, at Andrew D. Bailey, spelled exactly like it sounds. Please follow MBA Math at MBA underscore math. You can find at Hardwood Knox, where we're there too. And as always, I encourage you guys to leave us a rating, to subscribe, and leave us a review, even if it's a mean one. We just like hearing from people. So there will be no shout-out to Buna Udre tonight because Andy is not here. Until next time.